danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Tournament Poker Edge is your source for tournament poker strategy. From myself, from Nate Mavis, Carlos Welch, and lots of the guests that you've heard on this show, plus many other professional poker players, you'll find strategy for a variety of buy-ins, a variety of tournament types, live, online, small stakes, high stakes, everything that you need to improve your tournament game, available for as little as $25 per month at www.tournamentpokeredge.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 269 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Montreal, Canada, I'm Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts, and Matt Glassman in the ghost town that is the capital of the United States.
Hello.
So why is the capital so empty?
Well, Congress is out of session, meaning that they're not here meeting today, and it's a Friday. And when Congress is out of session and it's a Friday, Capitol Hill is really empty. Strangely so. Not quite as empty as when it's August recess here and all the staffers are on vacation, but very much still with an empty feel. You walk around the halls and you don't see anybody. The people you do see are often wearing jeans or maybe even shorts if it's hot out like today, and there's no one outside eating lunch, and now it's Friday afternoon, and Congress is not going to be in session next week, so not only is this not a session day, but it's the start of a recess. The House of Representatives is not in session. That's the side of the Capitol I'm on. And I'm actually at one of the office buildings next to the Capitol, and there's just nobody around. And, you know, it's a kind of a ghost town feel. It kind of feels like a dead mall, where there's lots of infrastructure to walk around, but there's no stores open, and you don't see any people.
And why are you there?
I was running a program this week for some employees in the executive branch, teaching them about Congress from Capitol Hill, and the program just ended, and they all left, and I'm still sitting here. I'm sitting in like one of these odd sort of banquet rooms on the House side of the Capitol complex in one of the office buildings where, you know, members might have receptions in the evenings, or, you know, interviews might come in and talk to people, or there might be a meeting, but right now it's just me sitting at like an empty banquet table in a relatively large room with my podcasting equipment. So it's I'm on Capitol Hill, I'm at the Capitol complex, but I don't really feel like I'm at the heart of sort of the American government right now.
And Nate's dealing with his own little, well, I guess you're not really, I mean, hardly the person most affected by the crisis, but what's going on with these gas explosions?
So there's a lot of rumor. So here's something I love about Boston, okay? Okay, I'm going to give you a long answer. Have you read Tyler Cowen's new book, The Complacent Class?
I read like a third of it.
Yep. Okay, so yep, Matt?
Same thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing I love about Boston is that it's not complacent. I think it's one of the least complacent major cities in the United States. So that's great. But... you know, so you get all this like innovation, and I think that we are relatively, you know, we're less in the grip of the belief that like comfort and safety is all you should want out of life, and I really appreciate that, especially as a parent. Okay, that said, a lot of shit doesn't work, and that's part of this belief. So like yesterday, for example, something like 60 houses blew up or had major gas explosions. And it seems so, like my house, for example, is a gas house. Like the heating is gas, and it's, you know, it's like this old fashioned thing. Big trucks full of gas go around and fill up our gas tanks, and then that's how we do it. And it's not very efficient, but like, you know, it's what we have, okay? And I guess somebody put a high pressure, or at least the most credible recent rumor that I've been hearing / reading is that somebody at Columbia Gas, which seems to be a subsidiary of some bigger thing, put a high pressure tube or pipe feeding into a low pressure pipe that fed into a bunch of people's houses. Okay. And I guess that's bad, and the high pressure makes things blow up. So a bunch of people's houses blew up. That's bad. That's bad. But also, like, there's a bunch of construction because it's summer, and local politics is interesting. And I'm just saying, you know, not to get, like, too political, but there's a lot of people who belong to public sector unions making a lot of hours today. Okay, whatever. There's a lot of stuff happening between the construction and all the other things. It's just very hard to get from one place to another place right now. That's okay. That's a long way of saying I was 5 minutes late for this. Yeah.
So this is shocking to me because I kind of vaguely had this idea that there was some issue going on in Boston with some sort of gas explosions, but on whatever news stream I'm getting, it was buried so far deep between the hurricane in North Carolina and various political things going on that it didn't occur to me, like, literally 60 houses exploded.
I mean, you know, that's like a slightly sensationalistic way of putting it, and, and but, I mean, like, things were blowing up. So far, I think there's only one fatality, which was somebody parked in a car that a chimney, like the house had an explosion and then the chimney fell over onto a parked car that somebody was sitting in, and that's the fatality so far. So, like, you know, it's not quite like, you know, like the whole house was incinerated. I think more than one person would have died, but, like, yeah, but it's like crazy. It's like, yeah, and then this is, you know, 2 miles away. It's like in Lexington. So yeah, you know, in other times this would be a major national story, right?
Sure feels like it.
Feels like it to me. Feels like it to me. Anyway, but that's, I mean, also, like, in the context of my life, like, whatever. I'm too busy betting on my own death to pay attention to that. It's buying life insurance is the polite euphemism for this. But
if you had said to me, like, well, how is Nate going to feel about acquiring life insurance? Like, too busy betting on my own death wouldn't have been the phrase I came up with, but it's the perfect phrase for how you would approach the situation.
Yeah, it's like, man, the odds I'm getting are great. Like, you add this up, like, even if you take into account inflation, like, I'm sure the company has the best of it, but, like, they're legit laying me, like, you know, like 100-1, maybe like 80-1 inflation adjusted. I mean, you know, that's not bad. 20 years. I mean, I'm a healthy guy. Like, they've got the best of it, but, like, I don't know. It's not like a sports book where you get like 50-1 on the Lions winning the Super Bowl or something. You know, it's if it's an unlikely thing, they at least have the decency to give you a good price.
I was trying to explain insurance to my oldest daughter. We were talking about the potential flooding in North Carolina. My in-laws live down there, and they evacuated to our house, and my oldest daughter was fascinated by the insurance market for floods, which obviously is very different than a functioning market in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But trying to explain that to a 10-year-old who, you know, has a little bit of sense of sort of like expected value and risk and variance is still not easy. And it dawned on me while I was doing this and speaking with some other people that a lot of adults don't understand kind of how insurance works as a basic kind of proposition bet and what you're trying to do there. It's like, you're not trying to get the best of it. That is not your objective here.
Yeah. I remember, like, being in a room full of, like, philosophy PhD students and casually saying something about, like, well, you know, trading off some expected value for huge reductions in variance. I mean, I guess that's what insurance is all about, so maybe that makes sense. And just getting a room full of blank stares.
Right, like,
just,
totally. like nothing. Yeah. Like, no response whatsoever. Even my wife, who I think understands the concept, as I was explaining this to the 10-year-old, I'm like, at some point I simply said, it's like, well, you're just trying to reduce the variance of the outcomes. And my wife's kind of like looking at me cross-eyed. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to explain it to you too.
Yeah. So this turns out to be a complicated process. It's like I have to go get blood drawn, and then, like, they have to send somebody to, like, come take more blood from me. And I have to, like, yeah, it's the whole thing. The whole thing is, interesting.
Yeah, the moment I found weirdest with the life insurance is when they're, like, asking you if you smoke cigarettes. Yeah. And my wife and I don't smoke and have never smoked, so it wasn't an issue for us. But, like, the way they phrased it, it was like, even if you do smoke cigarettes, you're going to need to lie to us right now because everyone else is lying to us. And so, like, the pool of people who do smoke and admit it become such like a negative for your like costs that like we basically have actuarial tables that are just assuming everyone's lying on the I don't smoke side.
Wow. Yeah.
It's like they don't like, I mean, and when you think about it, like when you have like major like markers of dying early, like things like smoking or other kind of like health risk behaviors, like unless you're going to like have a way to like verify these beyond like, you know, self-reporting, like you're going to have to accept tons of like cheating on these kind of questionnaires. And so I don't understand how the actuarial tables work until I did understand that they just you know, just have to build in the fact that people are lying about these things.
Yeah. Which isn't great. It's a thing to verify. I mean, if they're doing blood tests, I feel like they should be able to test for smoking in some way.
Yeah, perhaps. But I mean, like, that was not my sense. And there's plenty of, like, yeah, I mean, my sense was, like, from what they're talking, it's like, well, you don't smoke, right? And we're like, no. They're like, that's the right answer.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. I had to answer yes to, have you had a 10% weight difference, like, in the last year? Like, have you had a delta of 10%? But then you get to specify which direction and why, so I think I should be okay.
Yeah, congratulations on that.
Thanks, but, you know, it says more about where my habits were immediately after I became a father than what I'm doing now. But yeah, no, it's funny. So, yeah, I'm actuarially, you know, very likely to be able to keep podcasting for a while. So that's nice.
It seems like you accomplished your weight loss without the weight loss bets that have been so popular in the poker world.
Yeah, also without the like weird cultish like keto thing. It's like, I don't know. I have another like rant about this. Like, nutrition is very hard, and there's more to, you know, being healthy and losing weight or losing weight than like running a calorie deficit. But like, it's a bit like it reminds me of the efficient market hypothesis thing, where people say like, oh, markets are very inefficient, in fact you should, you know, like whatever, get really leveraged on Bitcoin and read all these newsletters, when it's like, you know, if you just assume the efficient market hypothesis is true and buy a fucking index fund, like,
right,
you're gonna end up in a good shape.
Right, all these things that are true to like a first approximation are actually like your best bet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
wait,
like,
Nate, do you really not have any negative commitment devices in place to help you do this? I would have expected you to at least do that.
So I worked out like 6 to 8 weeks before talking about it on Twitter. Then I publicly talked about it on Twitter so that I'll be embarrassed if I give it up. So there's that.
And that was strategic. That was like, used like, well, this is a negative commitment device I can use by publicly proclaiming this.
It was like part of it, but also I like to talk on Twitter, and I was like extremely confused. Like, I really, so here's like one thing, like, I've mentioned this on the show, is it's very hard, even if I'm willing to like buy books and stuff, to get any sense of what is possible or reasonable, like running and nutrition wise. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to like find out up from down. And I was really curious, like, if I ran a 1848 as a 17-year-old, am I just drawing dead to PR? Like, it's, I don't know, maybe. I couldn't find good information, so I also wanted to hear what people had to say. So thanks, Matt.
Yeah. I think that's one of those, like, really tough questions, because, so for me personally, like, the big independent variable was, like, once you don't have a coach and a team like whipping you, and like, to what degree was that going into like your original PR when you were 17? Because if it wasn't, and you were just doing this kind of like on your own, that is a huge variable that you, like, I mean, I guess you could replace it at this age, but you probably won't. You're probably just working on your own now. And I found that once there wasn't a coach screaming at you or teammates you could let down, like, the actual mental drive, not in the races, but just in the practicing, was just gone in a way that couldn't be replaced by any sort of, like, self-drive or anything like that.
Yeah, so for me, it's almost the other way. Like, I mean, the team element matters a lot, but, so I adore my high school cross-country coach, but, like, there was a lot of overlap between the cross-country team and the math team, and it was, like, an extremely geeky place, and, like, I never got minutely coached with respect to like my form and so on. So like my form was terrible, and a lot of what we were doing was like we thought about racing. So like the ability to focus on time trialing exclusively and not racing for the purposes of this goal is a benefit. And like being an old man and like being able to run for an hour and a half if I need to in a day, and actually like getting my form right. There's a lot of stuff that I can do now that I wasn't doing with a team, in part because it was just a sort of geeky prep school cross country team.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the actual key variable in this is your ability to avoid injury, and I don't think that's something that you can know, because I think the big part of drawing dead is if there's just an amount of training that is going to injure you, and that's entirely possible at age 35 or whatever.
Yeah. I'm icing something right now and taking 2 days off, which is killing me. I'm cross training instead, so I'm like swimming and like so on, because like I think it's okay, but like it's just a little tight between my Achilles and my calf. So like, and like the best running available to me is training trail running, so I don't want to do hills while this thing is tight. And like, yeah, and also there's no way to get good information, so I don't even know if I'm injured or not. It's that's the thing. It's all You completely nailed it when you said like there's just a path from A to B, and you either get injured or you don't, or like in theory I could be not motivated enough to do it, but like it seems obvious to me that my body is capable of running at 6 minute pace for 18 right. minutes 37 seconds, like I just have to get from here to there. It's like yeah.
I mean, I do think that maybe this has dawned on you, but it was right around age 35 where it started to be absolutely astounding to me that there were professional athletes in the major sports who were older than me.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the possibility that someone was pitching in the majors when they were 40 or whatever.
Yeah. No, I root for all the old guys, especially like, so like Victor Martinez, the Tigers player, like this was like 3 years ago now, when, and he's only a couple years older than me. He had a bad hip, and he was going to be out for a month or two. Then they said, like, oh, well, because of his age, we just did this other fix, so he'll actually only be out for 2 weeks. And it's like this guy, it's like, oh, no, he's too old to fix. Like, we'll just slap that up, you know. Yeah, he can't be saying, like, this old guy, get whatever you can out of him. He's got one foot in the grave already. And, of course, I'm as old now as he was then. But yeah, I have exactly that feeling. It's incredible to me, especially like basketball or something. Oh, where God.
Yeah, right. So I have some moderately big poker news.
Nice.
I have successfully gotten myself into a game in my neighborhood that I've been trying to get into for several years now, and the game is a tournament series where they ship people off to Vegas for the World Series of Poker.
Nice.
To win. So I have now found a route that now I have a non-zero chance of ending up in Las Vegas next summer for the WSOP 2019, which would be only 12 years behind schedule when I thought I would be back for the World Series of Poker. So I consider that pretty good, and I'm super excited about that. And I'm actually like kind of like re-energized to think about tournament poker, which is something I literally have thought about almost none in any real way since Black Friday, and even before Black Friday I was never really thinking about it in any sort of like, you know, serious study kind of way. So I'm super excited about that.
Nice.
And the getting into this game was just like, oh, what a trial. It's this tournament series in my neighborhood with like, you know, a dozen people in or whatever, but they only have a dozen spots, and you have to, you know, someone has to quit before you can get in. And so I've been playing these cash games that go along with this tournament series that goes for a full year, and I've been playing these cash games for years, just dying to get into this tournament series, and now I've done it. And presumably that means I will run terribly this year and not go to Las Vegas, but the probabilities are with me. It is not a particularly competitive league, and I feel like I have a significant edge over the field, and so I have a good mindset that I will, yes, be at the World Series of Poker next summer, which I'm super excited about.
Sweet. And like, is it like a one winner thing, or do they send people off to prelims, or
it's structured such that based on the entry fees and stuff, about half the prize pool. So they run 12 tournaments between now and the end of middle of May or whatever, And half the prize pool goes to paying out individual winners in these tournaments, placing, you know, it just says like a sit and go, basically, or a small two-table tournament. And then half the prize pool goes to fund, I think, two or three people to go out with enough money to play a couple preliminary events as they choose, or they can augment that money and play bigger events and things like that. You owe a significant portion of your equity when you go out back to the club. But it looked like, just looking at the terms of it and knowing the players are participating in it, I felt like it was not only something I wanted to get into, go to Vegas, but something that has a significant EV for me. I've always been one of the biggest winners in the cash games there, which is, like, I have to say, showing up at a place where, like, a cash game is going to start as soon as people bust the sit and go is really the ideal situation for a cash game. It's like, well, you just busted, and I'm sitting here at a table with two other people who want to play cash. Why don't you come over here and play shorthanded, deep stack, no limit for a little while, right off your sit and go bust? And that's really, it's really like, I mean, it's almost unfair. You almost feel like you're kind of like working as like a hustler there. It's like, well, there's a second poker table here, we might as well play. I mean, it's that kind of.
Yeah, this might end up being negative EV for you, Matt, if you're not playing the cash game anymore.
I have joked about this so many times. I used to walk over, so we'd be playing cash there, and I'd walk over to the tournament table. I'm like, you guys are the chumps here. What you should do is bust right now and get over to this cash table. It's where the real action is. And I actually think as an hourly proposition, it might be minus EV. But, you know, getting yourself in the tournament series also gives you a different standing in the club and things like that. So it may open up other opportunities. Like, I was talking to one guy just last night. We were playing cards, not poker, different cards. And he tipped me off about a game over at this Moose Lodge that he can get me into. And it's like, those are always weird moments, like when you find out about poker games that you're not really involved with and don't know anything, but someone can, quote, get you into. But but I'm all for those sorts of tips, you know. And then he told me about a couple people we both commonly know who are in the game. And it was really kind of just like straight out of rounders, like, that chosen that game, really?
for selfish reasons, I want you to go to the Moose Lodge, Matt.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to be playing some tournament poker over the next year, at least a lot more than I have been playing, and I'm excited to start thinking about tournament poker again, because I have not, like, considered, I really have not. I've played one tournament a year, basically, with my regular home game club tournament. So I haven't, like, spent a lot of time putting a lot of study time into tournament poker, but now I'm going to, and I'm not even sure how to do that.
If you need help thinking tournament poker, I have a resource in mind for you.
Yeah, I was considering that. I was like, I wonder if this is the kind of situation where I should be signing up for a tournament poker Edge membership, but I have not pulled the trigger.
I meant Nate has a book called Thinking Tournament Poker.
Oh, I think, yeah. Well, I, of course, have read that resource, and the big distinction there is that the first day of the main event of the World Series of Poker probably does not approximate the kind of tournament play I'm interested in, even in the closest. Like, I might as well read a book on backgammon, I think it's probably more so, but we will see. I don't know. I mean, I know some of the players from their cash game play, but I also think kind of a tournament series that's the same people, repetitive, a dozen times, is more interesting to me than typical tournament play, because I do like, one of the things I like about cash games is they're interacting with the same players repetitively, and home game clubs have obviously that effect. But having that in a tournament club is something that really appeals to me as a style of poker, because I think being able to exploit people who you know really well on kind of their own personal dimensions is its own sort of joy when you're playing poker, and makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah. No, definitely. And this will have complicated ICM effects with both, like, some sort of aggregate points for going out to Vegas and also immediate cash prizes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I it's one of those things where, like, I already feel like I have edge in the field because no one else is really thinking that way. Because mm-hmm. I was like, can I see the structure sheet? And they sent me, like, the blind schedule. And I'm like, no, can I see the structure sheet for, like, the points? And they're like, oh, and they just kind of, like, hand-waved it, like, here's how it works. And I was like, no, I want to see it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, Matt, come on, like, you know, like, first place gets more, then, you know, second also gets some. Or maybe it's three. Oh, wait, no, Joe got fourth that one time, and he was anxious. So now fourth gets a little bit also, I think. Or maybe
it very much has that feel, and it very much, like, it's I'm going to bring a scrutiny to it that I don't think is really being brought to it. And so hopefully that'll be like worthwhile, and then you know, and hopefully I'll be in Vegas this summer. Although I kind of think this is like, I was talking to my wife, I was telling her I was going to do this tournament series, and she's like, you just kind of want to go to Vegas for the World Series of Poker. I'm like, well, yeah, that's part of it. She's like, so if you lose the tournament series, you're not going to go to Las Vegas. I was like, well, I didn't say that. it's not really like that kind of proposition. But so, but at any rate, like, I think my prospects for being at the World Series are higher than they've been in a long, long time, and that's very exciting to me.
Fantastic. That's great. That's great. Yep. You did Vegas, right? This year or last year or whatever.
Yes, I was there for a bachelor party. My wife's youngest brother was getting married, so I was the old man at a bachelor party of people who were like in their late 20s, which was its own Vegas experience. But yes, I have been to Vegas, but that was the only time I've been to Vegas since the 06 World Series, so it's been a long time for me.
Yeah, it's and you played bridge with a legend and got a compliment out of him. Yes,
I did. Yes, I through the Thinking Poker podcast, I met Danny Sprung and played partners with him, including like just at the regular bridge club he plays with in Vegas, including playing against Bobby Wolf, who's like basically like the Doyle Brunson of American bridge. And so that was kind of surreal, both by like, you know, partnering up with someone I met through a podcast who also happens to be like a world-class bridge player, and then playing at a club, and we did well. So that was kind of like my head was spinning that day. It was one of those moments where you're just like, I cannot believe this happened to me. And I was like writing emails back to my bridge buddies here in Northern Virginia, and they were just kind of like very jealous and very kind of like drooling over the fact that I had done this. So that was, and it was also one of those weird things where it's like, it's no different than playing with like one of the legends of poker. If you're just sitting in like, you know, if you were sitting in a 10-20 game or a 10-25 game in the Bellagio and it was half empty, I was just sitting in this poker club or this bridge club, which is just kind of like a quiet, sedate room with people playing bridge. And some, but I'm sitting there with like one of the greatest players of all time playing against them. And so it has that same feel as like playing poker against famous people, where it's more kind of in your head that it's famous than the actual situation kind of demands it.
Not that this will come as a big surprise, but Danny Sprung has really improved. It's tremendous how quickly he's gotten quite good at poker, I think. I mean, when we first spoke to him, and he and I, you know, talked back channel a little bit about poker strategy, and it's just clear, you know, he was starting out in poker, and he had a lot of the common misunderstandings or whatever that people have starting out in poker. But obviously, he's a very savvy card player generally, right? I mean, that's probably understating it. And so he had a great World Series of Poker this year. He was 12th in the Monster Stack, which is a huge, huge tournament. I mean, this is a $1,500 buy-in, and that was good for like $72,000. So that gives you an idea of how large of a field the Monster Stack was. And then he's been very active on the Tournament Poker Edge forums also. And I can just tell, I mean, obviously anyone could like get lucky and do well in a tournament, but I can, and I played with him a little bit, by the way, during the WSOP various events, and he seemed to be playing well. And then I can just tell from the quality of his responses on the Tournament Poker Edge forums how much he's improved in, you know, whatever time it was, a year or so since we spoke to him. Or I guess it's been more than that. But yeah, not that it comes as a big surprise, but it's a good indication of how transferable the skills do seem to be from bridge to poker.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, I've only played bridge with Danny once, and I mean, he's obviously like a, you know, I think he's like, you know, there's the absolute world-class players, and then he's on like the one notch below them, basically. And I think part of it is that, you know, obviously there's things that transfer from the games as games. Like, the idea of a range is so normal to a bridge player that you'd be like, well, how could you not be thinking in ranges? Because you're always thinking about what your range is telling your partner and what your partner's range is telling you. And same thing with like the negative inferences about what the opponent's cards are. But it's also that I think he, like any kind of excellent card player, he has a sense of like how much information there is to gather, and he's more efficient at going about doing it, and he's already in all the right mindsets you need for like getting better at these games. Because I know it's the same thing, like we would email back and forth about hands, and like I have no doubt that he's a much better poker player than I am at this point. Just the way he talks about it and sees things just seem like he's just, you know, and he's, you know, for someone like him who knows, you know, the ins and outs of cards and how to think about how to study, it's just putting the time in. And now that he's retired, I think he has plenty of time to put in. And I agree with you. It seems pretty obvious that he's rapidly becoming quite a good tournament poker player.
Well, Matt, one thing that we were talking about before Nate got here that I thought could be interesting to talk about on the air also is the introduction of legal sports betting in the, well, I guess right now it's only in West Virginia and in Charleston, but
yeah.
That's kind of how casino gambling started in the Mid-Atlantic, and it's now spread into Maryland and Delaware. But it sounds like you're getting bombarded by radio ads for sports betting in Charlestown.
From Hollywood Casino and Charlestown Raceway. Come play our new sports book, right? You can't get away from it. And part of that is that Charlestown's clientele has always been, or at least in the recent past, has been a draw from the Baltimore area and to a lesser degree from Northern Virginia where I live. And then once Maryland Live opened up, and now MGM down in Southern Maryland, outside of D.C. and the Horseshoe in Baltimore, Charlestown has dried up, I think, in their number of people coming over there for quite obvious reasons. And now they have a new competitive advantage, which is that the sports betting was legalized in West Virginia in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. And it is not legal as of yet in Maryland. Virginia has no casino gambling right now. And so they are now back on the airwaves trying to lure people back to their sports books. And it's a little annoying. There are radio spots constantly that I hear about it. But I also presume it's not going to last long, because my guess is that, and I don't know anything in the politics of this, but just it seems kind of natural that Maryland's going to legalize this too. And I was telling Andrew before we got on the air that the new poker room at MGM is beautiful. It's up on the second floor, kind of all alone. But it also feels like exactly where they're going to put the sports book. If and when Maryland does legalize sports betting. Right now there's this little race book over there with this monster TV and kind of those little tables they set up for the people to watch the horse races. And the other end of the new poker room has this set of slot machines that kind of look out of place, and it looks like they could just easily be moved out of there to make way for a giant sports book. And I kind of feel like that's going to happen. And so the question came up, and Nate, I'd love to hear your opinion on this. Andrew asked, we kind of noted that the sports books and the poker rooms are always next to each other, it feels like, in casinos. And we were talking about, well, why is that? And Nate, do you have any theories about why that is?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. So I think the clientele sometimes overlaps, so that's part of it. I think poker players like to watch the game, so there's like a matter of physical infrastructure where they can put the big screen TVs in one place that'll serve everyone at the same time.
Right.
My first instinct was to say that if there are winners that get created at poker, they would like them to spend it at the sports book, but I think that's exactly wrong. I think if somebody has $1,000 that they're newly willing to gamble, the casino usually wants it someplace other than, you know, a sports bet they'll get 5% on or whatever.
Right. That, I mean, that's why the poker rooms are in the back of the casinos.
Right.
You have to walk through the pits to get out, right?
Yeah. And you don't have to walk through, you know, something boring with a small edge. Like, I don't know. I don't think, like, the food court. So let's see. So that's some of it. Yeah, I mean, there's, like, the cultural overlap. I do think there's some, like, positive, like, I think people who win at the one are probably more likely to really want to play the other. So there is a sort of there's a sort of synergy where different things that people might want are close to each other. Again, that right. cuts both ways, because there's the old theory that you put bread on one side of the grocery store and milk on right. the other, make people walk the distance, but there are also reasons to have essentials together.
Right, well, like, it's like if the poker players could choose it, like, it's a no-brainer that they would put the book next to the poker room, but, like, poker players aren't in charge of the casinos, right? Like,
no.
we know that for sure, right?
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where it's like, well, of course the book is next to the poker room. Like, where else would it be? But that's from the point of view of the consumer, not necessarily the point of view of the ownership of the casino.
Yeah. I think in some places the staff is, like, slightly overlapping. So, like, certainly they can send, like waitresses can do the one round, you know. But, like, I mean, they have waitresses everywhere, but maybe the rules are a little bit different. Like, I get the sense that at the Bellagio, at least, some of the same waitresses are serving the sports book and the poker room, and they would have to do their jobs a little bit differently if they were
player. That just be a consequence, right?
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, what we need is we need someone who was sitting in Vegas when they changed the sports betting tax rules and knows when it first exploded, what happened, and why they put it where they did, or just someone inside the industry who can tell us what the business model reason is, because I assume that's what's driving it. They don't do anything kind of by chance in those circumstances.
No.
Burke
no,
Brown, it's, are you listening?
Yeah. Burke, tell us why. Tell us why, Burke. It's, yeah, I do like being able to watch the game, on the nice screens, if you get the right seat. So,
but that also seems like an old-fashioned concern, too. I mean, if you go to the MGM Poker Room, there's only about 40, 50-inch televisions in there now, like in every position possible.
Yeah.
So they've just built the poker rooms, you know, equipped with all the games at this point, and they don't even have a sports book there, right? So it's not like... You know, it's not like, say, it's 1975 or whatever, and there's only 8 big TVs and all over the sports book.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I really don't know. Burke,
I really had a lot of hopes, Nate, in your being able to resolve this for us.
No.
I know. I thought you were going to have the anecdote that explained it. Yeah.
No, sadly not. There's a lot of continuity between the two, but I certainly do not. I mean, I don't do a lot of sports betting either. I'm not terribly plugged into that world, except insofar as some poker pros also do a lot of sports betting. Some of them even win at it. So, no, I'm officially confused. I stand by everything I said about the touching the chips thing, including the addenda from last week. So that I'm very confident about.
Well, Matt hasn't heard that yet, though.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Episode's okay. Not up.
Yeah, I was racking my brain there. I was like, I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Well, if you're okay, Matt, with talking a little bit of politics, also, I had a
yeah,
couple
of
things I was curious to ask you about.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, and I guess I haven't quite finished listening to the most recent episode of your podcast, Congress Two Beers In. So, and I know this is something that you touched on a little bit there, which is what gave me the idea for it. But we've often talked to you about paying attention to political news and reading it as a poker player, or thinking about the game theory behind it and the incentives of the actors and that kind of thing. And so the big news, one of the big things going on in D.C. right now is the potential confirmation of Kavanaugh and the sort of effect that that's going to have on the Supreme Court. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about what are the sort of institutional incentives of the Supreme Court. Like, I think we have a tendency to think of that as they're sort of like the wise, not just old men anymore, but sort of the wise people who are supposed to be making decisions just kind of based on the merits of a case. But, they do have their own incentives, not necessarily for their personal political gain since they're appointed for life, but just institutionally. What do you think people don't know about that they should?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing to say is that the court is more political than most people think. I think the most obvious institutional incentive for members of the court is that they do have life tenure, or they don't have life tenure. They have tenure on good behavior under the Constitution, which is not life tenure. They can be removed through the impeachment process by the House and Senate, and that basically never happens, short of a serious scandal. Of huge proportions, you're not going to be removed from the court by Congress. And so for all intents and purposes, you do have a life tenure there. And that's the most important structural feature of the court, is that you don't have to be responsive to either the voters or to the politicians in Washington for anything. They cannot, under the Constitution, even diminish your pay. You are going to get your salary and your retirement set up for life at that point going forward. And no one is going to be able to change that on you. And so that's the most important incentive. They are free to do things that aren't beholden to any sort of interest the way the political actors in the rest of the system are. And so that has a lot of consequences. One is that you don't have to serve the person who nominated you anymore. If Brett Kavanaugh wants to get on the court and all of a sudden for either selfish reasons or personal reasons or totally political reasons or just legal reasons or just that's how he reads the law, wants to decide the cases in a way that infuriates the Republicans, there's nothing they can do about it. The most they can do about it is try to use it to leverage other things for themselves, like the campaign on him being a turncoat or something. But they cannot affect him at all. So he does have, he would have total freedom, just as any other Supreme Court justice does. That said, I think a lot of people take that too far and think about the people in the court as not political actors. The courts are a thoroughly political institution in the sense that their decisions affect public policy just as much as any of the political branches do, and that they have to be thinking about things in political ways, both as they operate internally in the court and how their decisions affect kind of the outside world. Certainly inside the court, these are nine people who are operating an institution that they collectively serve in some ways in something that resembles a legislature in the sense that it's a cooperative endeavor. Okay, they're not the president. They don't have unilateral ability. Any one of the nine of them does not have much unilateral ability at all. And they have to come to a collective decision-making process, and that can become itself political. And being a good political operator inside the court can become very handy, because if you want to influence people, you certainly want to have certain strategies to do that, and you don't want to just go into it blindly. Being sort of an ideologue who bangs their fist and stammers and won't compromise, that can get you some places in politics, but it can also have people start to resent you, and when people resent you, they don't want to cooperate with you. And, you know, that sort of cooperation is necessary internally to the court. But the court also is a political actor in the sense that we have this general sense in modern America, most people do, that court decisions are final. And that when the court says something, that's just the way it's going to be. And one, that's not really how the Constitution sets it up, although it's kind of shifted to become that way. But most people forget that the court decisions have to be enforced. And for the court decisions to be enforced, they have to carry some political legitimacy. The most obvious way to look at this is when you think about like the Brown versus the Board of Education decision in 1954. Chief Justice Warren was adamant that that decision be 9-0. And he was going to work to get that decision to 9-0 on the court because he believed it had a better chance of being implemented by the executive branch and accepted in the southern states if it was a unanimous court. If the court came out split on that and it was 7-2 or 6-3 and there was a dissent that argued, you know, either strongly or just kind of maybe not even persuasively, but argued that segregation should still be legal under the Constitution, it was going to be a lot easier for the southern states to drag their feet on it and for the executive branch, frankly, under the Eisenhower administration to kind of soft pedal it if they didn't want to go about enforcing those decisions. There's the famous quote from President Jackson in the 1800s said, you know, John Marshall's made his decision, let him go enforce it now. And so the legitimacy of the court decisions is something the court needs to, as a political actor, work to protect. And you can see Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, doing this constantly. It really does fall to the Chief Justice sometimes to sort of preserve the prestige of the court, because that's what allows their decisions to have a legitimacy even when they're divided. And now that Roberts is going to be the center vote in the court, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, you will see him work even harder to do that. So, for instance, when he decided to take on the Obamacare case and ratify it as constitutional under his theory that it was a tax, part of what he was doing there was the decision came down and they can vote and it can be 5-4 or 6-3, but the person who gets to write the opinion gets to craft what the message is. And Roberts is very careful to craft messages that help ensure the legitimacy of the court or try to protect legitimacy of the court. And so that's one of the roles of the Chief Justice and the other justices is to make sure that their political power is not weakened by the decisions they make and the way they explain those decisions.
In terms
is that
of
what you're looking for?
Well, in terms of the institutional legitimacy of the court, is that something you think that's kind of particularly precarious right now? Like Trump is kind of known to the extent that he's like familiar with past presidents, it seems like Andrew Jackson is one that he's valorized and he's been kind of critical or dismissive of court decisions. Do you think there's like a particular concern right now about protecting that legitimacy?
I think there's citizens who are concerned about it, and I'm sure the justices have it in the back of their head, but the legitimacy of the court and the popularity of the court and the prestige of the court ebbs and flows. After the Dred Scott decision under Chief Justice Taney in 1857, the court's legitimacy was held in low regard, and you know, we see that at various points in the 20th century too. I think among liberals, you know, the court kind of lost a bit after Bush v. Gore, and then among conservatives after the gay marriage decisions, and maybe even a little bit after the Obamacare cases. But I don't think the court is in any serious danger of having a legitimacy crisis right now. If you look at public opinion polling, the court is still much more beloved by the public than almost all institutions in the United States, say perhaps the military. And so I don't think there's an actual crisis of legitimacy in the court at all. Now, is the court concerned about an actual headbutting crisis with the executive branch, where the executive branch may try to ignore a ruling of theirs? Well, a court always might be concerned about that, and certainly we have examples like during the Nixon tapes case, which is an 8-0 decision. One of the justices recused themselves, but when that decision came out, it was another one they wanted to be unanimous, and Chief Justice Berger wanted it to be a very forceful decision that was quote-unquote airtight and didn't have any wiggle room in it. And they did that because they were fearful Nixon might try to reject them. But I think they were also confident that if they had an 8-0 decision that Nixon tried to reject, the public would ultimately side with the court. And Nixon basically came to that conclusion too, because he briefly considered, ignoring their order to turn over the tapes, but then he consented. And I kind of feel like Trump's in the same spot. Like so many things with Trump, it's easy to talk about firing Robert Mueller or firing Jeff Sessions or ignoring a court order to, respond to a subpoena. But when you actually go to do those things, you really are in danger of wrecking your standing in the public sphere. And people underestimate how much that standing in the public sphere controls your fate. If President Trump were to ignore a court order of the Supreme Court to testify against a subpoena or something like that, he would very quickly lose a lot of Republican support, maybe even enough to bring down his presidency. And so those sorts of things, those sorts of moves are things the court worries about, but given their relative standing compared to the political actors almost all times, they don't have a lot to fear.
Nice. Thanks.
Or maybe I'm wrong. It's always possible too.
I don't know. I think your Neustadt, Neustadt. I think your Neustadtian positions on Twitter, they have not always been right, but you're looking very, very, very good. I think for anybody who's actually willing to sit down and look at facts and how this has played out, your early tweets about Trump and political power from that perspective are, I think you're winning there.
Yeah. Well, hopefully. Yeah. I mean, I think the more interesting examples now, because as a legislative presidency, I am still firmly on the side that the president is extremely weak and has gotten very little. He's done better where his interests coincide with those of other Republicans, including nominating judges and executive branch officials, and then passing legislation that Republicans would have passed anyway. But where you really see Trump being hemmed in by public opinion and the ability of other actors to counter him is on things where he has unilateral control but still can't do them. For instance, firing his attorney general. It is it is plainly obvious he wants Sessions gone from the Justice Department, and it's equally plainly obvious that he's not doing it because the ramifications of doing it would be just devastating to him politically. And that it's a perfect example of a place where actors in a political system can have all the formal power but have very little of the informal power. And this goes to the heart, again, of why, and I say this constantly on Twitter, why words matter when political actors say them. And you can't ignore senators when they say, don't fire Sessions, that would be a grave mistake. And you have all these liberals saying, well, that's cheap talk, why don't you do something? And, it's not cheap talk, it's effective talk, and it really hems in the president's ability to use powers that on paper he has the unilateral ability to use.
What is it precisely that could be the consequence for him? Like, suppose that he does sort of fire Sessions tomorrow. Like, what is it that Congress could do?
Well, for one, they could start impeachment proceedings. I mean, if you look at the articles of impeachment against Nixon, these are the very kind of things that are in there. These sort of meddling with the Justice Department in an ongoing investigations. And if they were to do that, and he were to fire Sessions, and, just a handful of Republican senators throw their hands up in the air and say, we're done defending you on this, either because they feel some sort of conviction about that, or because the voters have shifted in such a way that it is their incentives from their re-election point of view to do that, then his entire presidency could crumble. And, you know, that sounds kind of fantastical, but it's exactly what happened to Nixon. Nixon had pretty firm support among all the Republicans in Congress right up until the point when he didn't. And as soon as he didn't, it crumbled like a house of cards almost overnight. In July of 74 and early August of 74.
And I mean, just to sort of put a flashing light on the thing you just said, like the Ben Sasse press release about this ended with saying like, oh, this is a bad idea for America, da da da. And frankly, it's a very bad idea for the president.
And so, I mean, I think that's, you know, the interesting question is kind of like the turnout around in your face. Like, well, if there is no consequence, why isn't he just firing him? It's not even that I can say there's a consequence. It seems quite evident that the president thinks there's consequences. And they may not be as dire as he gets impeached, but every drop in your public opinion and every Republican on the Hill who decides they're done helping you, okay, or even are going to lessen the help of you, weakens your political position across all the other issues you want to do. You want that border wall? Well, the last thing you want to do is start alienating people across some other issue that they think is, you know, ridiculous. And so I don't even think you can think about it as an isolation. It's not just that firing Sessions would be bad for the president on the dimension of the investigations into the scandal surrounding his administration, but they would just drain his political power across any issue he wants to be influential on, and make it more likely on a marginal level that, well, yes, his presidency could come down, but more so that he won't get his way on any issue where he's trying to get his way. One of the little things that happens here is, so for instance, President Trump came out with his plan that he didn't want to have a pay raise for executive branch employees next year. And on the Hill, they're very much talking about overriding that by just writing it into a law. And, you know, it's one of those things where if he had more juice with them, he might be able to get his way. But because he has less for all these other reasons that have led to him having, you know, lower popularity and less credibility on the Hill, he probably won't get his way. And that's, you know, that's like some simple little nothing issue where they're just going to plausibly just tell him no. And if he fires Sessions, well, it's the kind of thing where they're not definitely going to tell him no, but they're more likely to.
Related to this, I've been kind of, maybe it's wistful thinking or speculating or whatever. I mean, I think there's a lot of concern among liberals or progressives about losing the majority they feel like they've had on the court for a while now. You know, that as you said, that the court has been friendly to a lot of progressive legislation for a while, and I think a lot of progressive politics has kind of focused on making change at the court level. And I think in the short term, like as a relatively progressive person myself, I think, like, you know, but I mean, it seems that regardless of whether or not Kavanaugh is ultimately confirmed, like whoever gets confirmed is not going to be favorable in that way. And I think, like, short term, that's going to have a lot of bad consequences. But I do kind of wonder whether the court is really the best venue for trying to make those changes, or if that hasn't been some level of kind of laziness. Like, it's certainly a way to quickly and easily get your way compared to having to, you know, build a political coalition. But for exactly those reasons, it seems like change created at the court is also less durable. And I think the fact that we're still fighting about Roe v. Wade 50 years later is pretty good evidence of that.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common viewpoint. And I think it's relatively right with one caveat. I do think that the legitimacy of decisions made by legislatures definitely has a stronger appeal than those made by courts. And if you allow, for instance, civil rights or gay marriage to spread legislature by legislature, it'll be more accepted by the public, and that can have all sorts of ramifications. The drawback is that you end up having sort of sets of recalcitrant states and things like that in the South, obviously on civil rights, and plus being other places on gay marriage had been there no court case. And yes, when something like Roe happens, you kind of freeze possible compromises. And so if you look at abortion rights throughout, like, Europe, they're in kind of this, you know, centralized position that's something like a position that is more moderate than what the United States had before Roe, and more moderate than what the United States has after Roe, and that you kind of just freeze the political debate, and that's kind of the Roe story. On the other hand, it's also true that decisions made by the court can be kind of progressive leading decisions. Certainly the Brown decision on desegregation had that effect, where this was not really moving at all at the political level. And that had a galvanizing effect to create momentum for the entire civil rights movement. Now, all that said, I think liberals placing their faith in the court is generally historically misguided. The courts have, throughout American history, been, in general, much more friendly to conservative interests and have been the defenders of sort of conservative business interests throughout the 19th and 20th century in most cases, striking down many more liberal laws about economics than conservative laws. So I think there's kind of this Warren Court era in the post-war era where liberals found there was an activist liberal court under Warren, and a lot of decisions were made that they liked, and they decided that the Supreme Court was a place that defended kind of the downtrodden and the individual fighting against the powers that be. And in general, that's not really true in American history. The courts have more often forestalled those sorts of movements than helped them. And so it wouldn't surprise me if a court resumes that sort of mantle in the future, and that a lot of liberal faith in the court is misplaced.
Are there people who, I guess, would have, like, interest groups, I'm thinking, maybe an incentive to sort of maintain the court as the venue where those battles are being fought, even if it's not actually the one where success is, like, as you say, historically it hasn't been the most successful venue? Like, are there institutional reasons why there are people who might want to continue sort of, like, pushing things in that direction anyway?
Well, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, there's no, like, coordinated, like, set of liberals in America, no coordinated set of conservatives. There are organizations like the political parties and interest groups that
Soros is coordinating them, Matt.
Yes, exactly. It's all one person. But, like, you know, I mean, first of all, the court takes court cases, right? And lots of court cases are ginned up in order to get the court to decide something, but a lot of them aren't, right? And they just come forward, and the court is going to make decisions that actually affect the parties involved in the court case. And you can't stop that from happening, and no political party can stop someone from challenging the constitutionality of the Civil Rights Act or challenging the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act or any other law that is made. And certainly, you know, for all the policy haranguing about abortion at the court, Roe v. Wade has been the biggest boon ever for fundraisers on both the left and right in the last 50 years. And plenty of people enjoy that. And I think there's plenty of politicians on both the left and the right who would just prefer, from a political point of view, that the Roe v. Wade decision stand, and so that they can continue to fundraise off it. Plenty of politicians who are scared of the decision being overturned because it might mean that state legislatures would have to battle about this, and they might be terrified about the prospects of that. And so there's all sorts of interests that, for their narrow purposes, prefer the court to be heavily involved in politics, prefer to be activist, and may even prefer to be making decisions that cut against their narrow judicial interests. For instance, there's, you know, nothing has been a better fundraiser and driver of a certain stripe of liberal politics in the last decade or two than the Citizens United case. And that cuts directly against the interests of a lot of liberal groups. But boy, has it ginned up a lot of political motivation for certain groups on the left. And so, yeah, so people, I think, sometimes are just as happy to lose at the court if it will allow them to achieve other political ends in the legislature or in the electoral arena.
Do you see an upside to that kind of incentive? Because I think it aligns with a lot of people's negative views about politicians who are sort of saying one thing but actually wanting something different. I mean, it kind of sounds skeezy, but it sounds like you do see an upside to that, I guess.
I mean, I don't know if I see an upside so much as it's like I think of politics as the whole of this system, and you're never going to, like, you know, anything that goes on in politics can be taken as sincere or strategic, like literally anything. A speech you give, an amendment you introduce, a bill you try to pass, a campaign strategy you adopt, all of them can be sincere and all of them can be strategic. And sort of arguing that you should only be able to do sincere things is kind of silly, because everything is both sincere and strategic, or could be sincere and strategic. And divining which one it is, I don't think is particularly helpful, since they're both always going to exist. Everyone in DC is a cynic, is what people say, but, like, I kind of think of it more as, like, everyone's a realist, right? And there's no referee in politics telling you what's right or wrong, and there's no fair or unfair in politics in the sense that there's no neutral judge who is going to tell you, well, that was out of bounds or that was in bounds. And, you know, this is one of my biggest complaints about people who dislike Trump, when people don't like Trump because, you know, he's not doing it the way you're supposed to do it. Well, there can be negative consequences to breaking norms and things like that, and you may want to say that, but, like, to say, like, the way the president is engaging in politics is inherently out of bounds strikes me as a type of fencing off of behavior that is absolutely illegitimate, right? It's like, no, you don't get to decide how other people practice politics. And so I don't think it's necessarily a good thing if people are at the court arguing one way and, like, just as happy as they lose because they can walk home and go, wow, now we can raise a ton of money. But, I mean, that's how it is. Like, there's not, you're not going to, you know, if you pretend it's not that way, you're delusional. And if you hope it's not that way, great, but it's going to be.
Fair enough. Sorry if I misattributed something to you.
No. I don't necessarily like that, but I mean, I do think that, like, accepting, like, strategic action as the fundamental basis of politics, like, you don't want someone representing you not being as, like, strategic as possible on your behalf. So when they're as strategic as possible on someone else's behalf, I don't see why that is, like, somehow necessarily a bad thing.
Maybe I'm forcing a poker analogy, but it reminds me a bit of the people who think that, you know, check raising is, I mean, I don't, it's not really a common opinion anymore, but yeah, that check raising is just sort of intrinsically unfair. Like, that's not supposed to be part of poker. That's not, you know, raising too much before the flop. That's an illegitimate tactic.
Right. Or like not soft playing grandma, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you didn't soft play grandma, so you're, like, a bad person. Well, I guess so, but, like, this is a game, right? It's like, you know, it's like, well, right, if you don't want me to try to win, right, you can just say, we don't want you to try to win. But, like, well, what does that even mean in the context of a game, right? But, again, it also goes back to people having different goals in poker games and in politics, right? If the goal of a poker game is to have grandma enjoy it, well, maybe you don't want to soft play grandma. But, like, on the other hand, like, maybe grandma doesn't want you to soft play grandma, right? And we don't know people's motives or their reasonings for those things.
My grandmother definitely did not get nor needed to get soft played in any card game.
Yeah, no, mine neither. And if I had soft played grandma, I think grandma would have sniffed it out and yelled at me for doing it. And that's fine. But you know what's funny about the you can't check raise anecdote, I feel like that's better known now as an anecdote implying something than actually is something. Like, I don't remember, like, anyone getting upset about check raises even when I was playing in, like, the early 90s. It was already kind of a thing that some people don't like, or was quoted that way as, like, an example of, like, that sort of thing. And now it's like, I mean in your life, have you ever run into someone who thinks check raising is uncouth?
I did, but it was 15 years ago, and it was a friend of my grandfather's who was, you know, my grandfather's age. So, you know, his idea of poker norms had probably been established, you know, 40 years prior to that.
Right.
And it was extremely amateur. So, I mean, this was not probably anyone who'd ever played poker in a casino. You know,
right.
It was an extremely recreational setting.
Right. What they didn't like was check and raise.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen men shot for less was the exact quote that was leveled at me with an icy stare.
I've never had somebody say that you know, check and raise is unethical, but I have gotten dirty looks for doing it, like, especially in limit hold'em games, maybe 10 to 12 years ago, where a lot of people are playing, like, did I win? There was an attitude towards some people that, like, even betting, even, like, value betting the river was sort of out of place, especially if you were friendly. And then, like, yeah, and then, like, check raising the river, it's like, oh, come on, like, you can't drive me out of the pot now. I'm not going to fold. Like, it's like, what are you doing, like, making me pay all this money?
So here's the thing. It's like, if you said there's no check raising in our game of seven stud, I'd be like, well, that's stupid, but okay. If you say there's no check raising in a hold'em game where there's a fixed position, it's not even a game anymore. Like, why, how could you ever play any hand out of position, right?
Yeah.
Like, your option on this hand is to check call or check fold, right? Like, I mean, it just seems like it distorts the entire concept of a fixed position poker game.
Yeah, but I mean, but you've played these people in limit games who are playing did I win, and who just it's like oh fuck, you're raising, why'd you raise it? Hey, just bet. It's like, ugh. Yeah. Like, really? I thought we were friendly. Now you're raising me on the river. It's like, I'm starting to think that second pair is no good, but I am not gonna fall.
Right. Now I'm just gonna have to pay you off.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like, I'll teach you. I'm not gonna fold to you. I'm gonna catch you, little guy. Yeah.
God help you. So I don't know. That's not the same as saying. And you're raising.
Oh yeah, and I mean, yeah, no, that's right. It's so I would say there are negative attitudes. There are sort of quasi ethical attitudes around check raising in a lot of places that don't quite get to the full blown belief that check raising is not okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So our official stance is that it is okay. We're in favor of allowing check raises in poker games.
Allowing check raises is good, yeah.
Maybe we should also hear from listeners and see what they think.
Yeah. Also, Andrew is still the most popular host of the show, but I've pulled him significantly to the right, so I'm saying this is okay. I think this is okay. It's like he had to go through the primary season. So.
Anything we're leaving on the table?
I don't think so. I actually have to run. I got a buddy here, and we're due for a happy hour at the end of a trying week in Washington. So,
trying week, but enjoy your happy hour.
Oh yes, I will. It was good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure. Always popular. Yeah. It's,
always happy to do it.
Appreciate it. All right. Good luck.
Take care.
All right. Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Sleepless nights. Do I need some kind of pill or the devotion of a car? The light of the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us up?